This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we come together to have good conversations. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, we are thinking about one of the biggest stories of 2017. The activism at the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline was one of the biggest stories of 2017, where hundreds of people gathered to fight a pipeline that they said threatened the water supply on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and areas beyond that. Mark Hullman is the library director at Sitting Bull College on the reservation, and he recently presented at the University of Minnesota Duluth a presentation called Standing Rock, A Librarian's Response. He spoke with Lisa Johnson at KUMD in Duluth about the role that libraries play in capturing history.
Mark, you're also a member of the community there, obviously, at Standing Rock. So were you involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in any capacity, just as a private citizen also?
Well, I think just, you know, supporting the community is an important part of, you know, what I do personally and what we do at the library. So, you know, it was a big part of what everyone on Standing Rock was participating in. So we tried to support where we could. And I guess mainly being a library and trying to, save and archive the story going forward is something I continue to try to do. And it's had some successes and failures, and I'm continuing to try to gather both documentation and, you know, photographs, video, but also artifacts from the protests. And we actually have a little area in the library now where some of that stuff is displayed. And, you know, because now it's a time for memory. It's a time to, you know, it's been a year plus, and so people are coming through and sort of remembering those experiences, and it's sometimes hard to believe because it's as one commentator who was a radio person from the East Coast who had come through said, you know, who comes every year said, you know, it's like nothing happened. It's like everything's the same as it was before when I came a year previous. But it was an amazing, incredible, stressful, all those things, time, and a piece of history. And so we need to analyze it going forward, because even being so close to it here, it was hard to know what was actually happening or what actually happened. It was just a whirlwind that we all sort of lived through.
Mark, we're used to thinking about a library as a place that you can go to find out about things and find out about events and find perhaps photographs and documentation. But we're not as used to thinking about a library as a place where folks are actively archiving and preserving moments in history as they're occurring in real time. Can you talk about that role of your library? Is that kind of moving outside a library's traditional role, or is that actually very much a part of what a library you believe should be doing?
Well, it depends on the library and it depends on the community, I guess. And every library sort of, you know, molds into the community it lives in. And I think especially a college/public library like us, I mean, we serve both the local Standing Rock community and the public. And the library is the only place where, I think, public place where people can come and you can spend all day, spend no money, and get free stuff. And so public libraries are real gems in our community. I had gone by what some of my predecessors had done, gathering documentation from, you know, past things that had happened, you know, like some of the things from the 1970s and such. And I thought, well, maybe we can do this. We can try to grab things as they're happening, because sometimes things happen and you go, oh, we should have saved that. We should have been more active in, you know, saving that stuff before it was lost. And so that was sort of my thing, is to jump in there and try and say, hey, you know, if you're looking for a place to give your photos and or documents or whatever, you know, we're here. And I guess that was, in the beginning, it was very much a Standing Rock thing, but then it grew into this sort of, I don't know, international, national sort of thing that sort of transcended my ability to keep up. And you know, I guess I'm still trying to catch up.
Mark, before I forget, I want to ask you right now if there is, what if people have photographs, documentation, memorabilia, fill in the blank, and they'd like to contribute it, is what's the best way? How should folks get in contact with you to make those arrangements?
Sittingbull.edu. We've got a website. My email's on there. And that's the thing, is that I think a lot of people have stuff. And, you know, like us here, it was sort of, you know, life goes on and everything happens so quickly, and then you forget, you know, you forget about some of this stuff you have, you know, because it was a very stressful time for a lot of people. And so now people are starting to think, oh, I have all these photos, and maybe looking for a place to give them. And I mean, there's other entities as well, I know, that have been doing the archiving because it got so big. I know... I went out one day and I was looking for stuff to grab, and during those last days when of the camps, and somebody said, "Oh, the Smithsonian got the pole, you know, the famous pole with all the signposts on it, the mileage markers." And I said, "Oh, okay."
Yeah, who gave them that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was very very kind of. Disorganized at the end, and it was hard to know who, you know, things were very chaotic, I guess, and it was hard to know. There wasn't really a good contact, organized contact.
Right. Well, no one could have expected in the tiny town, you know, in your tiny town, that what was going to transpire there was going to happen and be as big as it turned out to be. I've got to ask you, Mark, as a book nerd, when things began to happen in Standing Rock, as a fellow book nerd, and you're a librarian, were there books that were speaking to you at that time as, this is a valuable read, this speaks to this experience, I wish I had time to go back and look at this book or these books, or, you know, I remember I read something that seems applicable to this situation. What books were talking to you at that time?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, just, I mean, there, the book that I guess I was looking for wasn't really written. I mean, it was, I think, maybe it will be written, but, you know, like you said, I don't think anybody thought it would get to be as big as it did become. It was, I mean, personally, I can only speak for myself, but I thought, well, it'll, you know, we'll have this little protest and there'll be legal action, but that'll be it. But it just, it maybe it was tied up with the political mood of the country and everything last, you know, fall of 2016. But, and that's unfortunate because I mean, there wasn't a book that really spoke to me, I thought. And that's, I mean, I feel terrible as a librarian saying that.
I think your words are very, I've heard more than one author on this show say, I couldn't find the book that I needed, and so they wrote it. So, you know, I'm perhaps after the whole situation's had a little more time to digest and you've had a chance to spend some more time with your archived materials and the materials that are coming in, I see like an author thing in your future, Mark.
Oh, yeah, I think. And now there, I've actually been purchasing, you know, pretty much anything that's published that has anything to do with the what's happened. And there's some things coming out, and I guess I haven't really looked deeply into any of them, but it's all part of the story. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, my hope is that there's some journalist out there like you know, PBS does this so well, and NPR, and who digs deep and, you know, really, you know, a front line to, you know, one of the PBS shows, I mean, something like that on the protest, because I think a lot of us are like, okay, what was that? You know, what was it about? What's its long-term impact? What's its legacy? That's the story I think we're telling now.
Mark, what a fascinating conversation. Thank you so very much for joining us this morning. It was a great pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and it's good talking to you, and, you know, stay warm.
Exactly. We'll enjoy the day. Thanks again, Mark.
That was Mark Holman, the library director at Sitting Bull College, visiting with Lisa Johnson at KUMD in Duluth. Coming up next on Main Street, the overlap between people who work with food and people who work with immigrants.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
And Mary, around here, men just don't make pies. Yes, my husband-to-be had committed the grievous error of showing up at the Hamilton family Thanksgiving bearing homemade apple pies.
Join us for true stories about women. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Connecting our communities through food. That's one goal of Ugly Food of the North and Cass Clay Food Partners. The groups work to create healthy, sustainable food systems. On the first Friday of the month, they host speakers whose work overlaps those missions. Yoksim Gunaratne is the Executive Director of Cultural Diversity Resources, an initiative to address the challenges and opportunities of increased cultural and ethnic diversity. The organization was founded in 1994 by community leaders who looked at the census information trends about ethnic diversity.
So in 1980, it was 2%. 1990, it was 4%. And then 2000, you have about 8%. And right now, you will see close to about 10% or so. Now, who are those? And obviously, you know that the refugee resettlement is one factor. And so you have a lot of people from many different countries. The two largest group really is the Bosnians and the Bhutanese right now. And then you have the Somali next. And now the Congolese are resettled here, Kurdish, and also the Iraqis and Liberians and Haiti and so on. Now, we also serve, cultural diversity also serve the minorities. And you see increasing numbers of Hispanic population and also African Americans, and we can't forget about the Native Americans too. So we do cater to some of those issues. Now, the interesting part is people ask why they want to have cultural diversity. They had a community forum in 1993, and in the community forums, they decided that diversity is one area that they had to focus on because at that time, there were no programs, no organizations to address the issue of diversity, despite the fact that the ethnic population was increasing. So they actually had three things identified, and diversity was one of them. They applied to Pew Foundation, very proud to be part of Pew Foundation. They gave us quite a large amount of money to set a three-year project in 1994, and it was to say address both the challenges and opportunities of dealing with diversity. And when you talk about diversity, it's a lot of stuff, but we're really talking more about cultural and ethnic diversity that we have. They got the grant, and that's how to address diversity, but also to develop some action plans to see what would happen then. Our mission is to serve as an intercultural bridge so that we can facilitate a bond, strengthen the bonds, and also to facilitate, you know, conversations and understanding about diversity. So the mission, one word, intercultural bridge. And you see why what we're doing in terms of linking new immigrants with veterans immigrants who have been here for a long time. The goals, I very quickly say, increase understanding of diversity, but also more important is the second one, is to say that we want to create opportunities, by eliminating the barriers to community participation. I don't know about you. If I was sent to Germany or any other country that I don't speak the language, you have a lot to learn, but also to adjust to the cultures and the rules and policies that we have, and also to participate in the community too. So what have we got to do with food? And I have to say that we have a couple of programs that we'll mention now that emphasize about food. One of them is definitely saying that food is a very basic need. I don't care who you are. What we did was we wanted to foster using food in some ways, personal, social, economic, and community connections and development in a very, very creative and entertaining way. I don't know about you. Food is a non-threatening, non-political way of really bringing people. When I have programs, they say, no, what are you going to bring for the food now? And you deal with ethnic people, I'm even more excited to come. We recruit and refer individuals, particularly those that we're dealing with has racial, social, or economic disparities, because those are the ones that we feel need more help than anything else, or they would like to be part of the community. And so we ask them to participate in the community gardening. I also believe that, you know, you have a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. What do we do with it? So we started organizing, connecting them to Extension, both Minnesota and North Dakota Extension, to take their nutrition classes and also their cooking classes. In fact, I had 10 individuals who are bilingual. One of the problems we find working with refugees is that if they have limited English proficiency, they have both not just cultural but also language barriers. So some of the 10 people who took over 6-8 weeks of training is trained a trainer cooking with Minnesota Extension. They became they're able to, you know, do the cooking class and train others in Somali and also Arabic too. And also, I have to have a story about cooking. There was a Kurdish family who came and brought a lot of her kids and family, and they just loved the smoothies. In fact, the husband said to the wife, he says that, I love smoothies and it's so important in breakfast, and he just loves it. It has made an impact for the family to eat in a healthy way. Food also is building community, and we started Pangea Cultivator Culture. Some of you might know. We started it in 1994. Basically, it was a way to get people from different cultures to get together so that they can have dialogues. It's growing because when I started it in 1994, there was only 500, and I just go to the different schools. We have food, we have cultural activities from different countries so that people can, you know, dialogue and socialize. And it's really a partnership with the Historical and Cultural Society in Clay County and also Lutheran Social Services, because by the time I partnered with those two organizations in 2000, it has grown from 500 to about 1,500 or even close to 2,000 now. So I think it's just wonderful to see that. It is in some ways a way to have people connect with diverse individuals and also at the same time enjoy what you're doing in an entertaining way. The Bush Foundation has given us a community innovation grant for the past 3 years, and has brought a lot of the small ethnic groups who are serving the ethnically diverse communities to kind of join forces with us. And a multicultural alliance was started in 2013. They represent a coalition of very small and emerging groups, whether they're Somali groups or Arabic groups or Kurdish group. We have been working very closely now, beginning too with the Daughters of the Earth, the Native Americans group too. The whole idea is to have a voice for them and work together. I'm a strong believer that we need to maximize limited resources, but also to help each other not to duplicate services, because the funds are limited, community resources are limited, and they don't know how to access traditional social services. It is the social services, Clay and Cass County. It is Lakes and Perry. It is Family Service. It's Fargo and, you know, Fargo-Cass Public Health or Clay County Public Health or Extension in particular, and the schools. All those are things that we can link through our connections with the ethnic leaders. In conclusion, I want to remind about the mission serving as a cultural bridge that strengthens bonds and facilitate understanding about diverse communities. Now, the food plays an important role because it's a way to bring people together and to strengthen, able to strengthen some of the social and community bonds. It is also fostering conversations and dialogue about food and its culture, and it also create a very safe environment, an inclusive environment too, because, you know, we don't have any barriers in terms of the food. So it's very inclusive to be able to welcome them. And in a sense, you're also coming together to share, to learn, and connect. I always use the word is to learn, is to share, to connect, and to empower. And in my case, I think with Culture Diversity and the Multicultural Alliance is to empower ethnically diverse communities and their leaders to collaborate on future food activities or events that you may have. Food is a powerful tool to create local connections and to enact some positive change in our communities that we need. Thank you.
That was Yoksim Gunaratne, the Executive Director of Cultural Diversity Resources in Fargo, speaking at an event called First Fridays at B, a monthly meetup at Moorhead's Theater B, devoted to important food topics. You can watch the stream at facebook.com/FMUglyFood. Natural North Dakota is next.
Teachers, are you tired of boring professional development? What if you could choose your own professional development, share your expertise, and learn with and from other educators like you? Prairie Public, along with the Missouri River Educational Cooperative, EduTech, Mayville State University, and the North Dakota Center for Distance Ed, bring you EdCamp North Dakota.
One time at EdCamp.
One day, two sites, 150 educators, unlimited learning. Continuing education credit is available. This innovative event is free, but space is limited, so register today at edcampnd.k12.nd.us.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and a lot of times at these temperatures, you start thinking about somewhere warmer, maybe like going to visit a desert. Well, Chuck Lura in this week's Natural North Dakota says you might be a little surprised to know that this area used to be thought of as a desert.
The Great American Desert came up in conversation recently. You may recall from your American history classes that back in the 1800s, explorer Stephen H. Long coined the phrase to describe the Great Plains. The Great American Desert was bound on the west by the Rocky Mountains. The eastern border was a bit more variable. Some people placed the eastern boundary at the Missouri River, but more commonly the eastern boundary was set at the 100th meridian. Dunseith, Rugby, Steele, and Haig lie close to the 100th meridian here in North Dakota. The term desert had a different connotation back then. It was not so much a vegetation type, but a largely treeless area unsuitable for cultivation and thus settlement. Flash ahead to the 1980s, and we hear about a proposal to turn the area into a buffalo commons. Remember that dust-up? Some of that perception of this area is related to precipitation. Moisture-laden air coming off the Pacific Ocean gives up most of the moisture and precipitation over the mountains. As a result, precipitation is comparatively low just east of the Rockies, but increases eastward. Miles City, Montana, for example, averages about 12 inches of precipitation per year, while Fargo averages 22 inches. The conventional wisdom for much of the 1800s was that annual precipitation of 20 inches was the bare minimum required for growing crops. That roughly coincided with the 100th meridian. So for much of the 19th century, the 100th meridian marked the western boundary of suitable farmland, and the eastern boundary of the Great Plains, and of course, the Great American Desert. Many people will cringe at the 100th meridian being the western boundary of suitable cropland. Looking around the state, we're seeing more and more cropland in the Great American Desert. And of course, that's at the expense of native prairie, which is going, I'll save that for a later spot. But consider this. North Dakota's a little different, but in South Dakota, where the Missouri River roughly bisects the state from north to south, and a bit west of the 100th meridian, life is quite different for people living east or west of the Missouri River. South Dakotans often refer to themselves as being from East River or West River. East of the Missouri River, expect to see a preponderance of feed caps and perhaps tennis shoes. West River, it's all cowboy hats and cowboy boots. It's largely farming in eastern South Dakota. Western South Dakota is ranching country. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, Harvest Public Media looks at hog breeding, and Chef Rosie is serving up smelt. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue visits the Fargo-Moorhead area tomorrow. He'll tour American Crystal Sugar and the Red River Valley Agriculture Research Center. He'll meet with NDSU agriculture students, and he'll hold a roundtable with farmers and others in the ag industry. North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hoeven says it's important that Perdue is visiting now because Congress is writing a new farm bill.
I've known Sonny for a long time. We were governors together. You know, he grew up on a farm. He understands agriculture. He is for farmers and ranchers and will do all he can to help us. And so this is a great opportunity for him to hear directly from our producers and our commodity groups.
Hoeven says he also wants to stress the importance of trade to North Dakota. He says he is concerned that the potential tariffs on steel imports may cause other countries to impose retaliatory tariffs on farm commodities, oil, and other exports from North Dakota.
And so anything that's done has to be very targeted, focused, and strategic, and make sure that it helps our overall economy. You know, we're making real progress with tax relief and with regulatory reductions. We're seeing improvements in our economy and our economic growth and job creation, improving wages and income. But at the same time, we've got to be able to have trade, and so it's a big issue.
Foreign countries are likely to target commodity crops, peanut butter, even Florida orange juice in retaliation for proposed taxes on imported steel and aluminum. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains why it might be a positive thing for consumers.
If President Trump imposes the tariffs, canned goods might cost a bit more, but juice, peanut butter, and corn and soybeans fed to hogs and chickens could be discounted. Wes Peterson is an agricultural economist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says if you cut off demand from some of America's biggest trade customers, you'll end up with too much supply.
And that means that they're buying less, and that means that we have more left in the United States, and all things equal, prices will go down.
Peterson also says when consumers get a better deal on food, it comes at the expense of farmers because a surplus will push down crop prices. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue says retaliation is a concern, but tariffs put the U.S. in a stronger bargaining position in talks over trade deals like NAFTA. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And a federal election assistance commissioner says voting systems are like most information technology systems. They're subject to attack. Matthew Masterson talked to county auditors from around North Dakota who were in Bismarck for election training.
Election officials already know what to look for. They know their processes, their procedures, and what things steps they need to take. But it's taking the simple blocking and tackling steps of securing their data.
Those steps could include auditing and evaluating the results on election night, making sure passwords are strong and access is restricted.
IT security is a part of the reality of elections and has been for a while. It's been a big topic of the public conversation over the last 2 years, but for election officials, since having electronic voting systems, IT management and managing IT systems is a part of our reality, and so securing those systems is a big part of that work.
Masterson says he wanted to reinforce the point that they have to be aware of malicious actors who will try to hack their IT systems.
The fact is that election systems, like any IT system, are a target of hackers, whether they be nation states or others. And so taking the steps to secure those systems is critically important, and election officials are doing that.
Masterson also says election officials have to tell voters the systems are safe and protected so the voters can have confidence in fair elections. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. U.S. farmers send more than 170 million hogs to market each year. That's a lot of ham and bacon. To breed for that amount of pork, farmers rely heavily on artificial insemination. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, it's an industrial industry based in biology and groceries.
Recently, my friend Kim was at the grocery store with her son when a man behind them placed 40 dozen eggs on the conveyor. She asked what he'd be doing with all those eggs and posted his answer on Facebook.
I asked him to repeat it to make sure I understood. We use them to stabilize boar semen so we can ship it to Asia. I have so many follow-up questions, but we were almost late for school and had to go.
Yeah, that could have been me or it could have been a number of people here.
This is Michael Doran, Chief of Operations at Swine Genetics International, about 20 minutes from that Iowa store. The company has three barns that are home to only male pigs, and their semen is what the company sells. SGI ships it, fresh or frozen, across the U.S. and to 40 other countries.
These are actually the straws.
On the way to one of the barns, an employee passes us carrying empty plastic straws.
When you order a dose of frozen semen, you get a straw that's got the boar's name, their pedigree registration number, the date it was
Keeping
thrown.
The semen viable, especially if it's going to be frozen and then thawed before use, is tricky. That's why University of Nebraska-Lincoln swine extension specialist Benny Moat says most companies ship it fresh. Either way, the cells are fragile, so Moat says the semen gets mixed with something called an extender, which gives the sperm nutrients.
So that way you can keep having energy to swim and then preserve the shelf life, if you will, of it.
Moat says in the early days of artificial insemination, extenders often contained egg yolks. While SGI still uses eggs, most of the handful of companies supplying the $191 million market for boar semen have switched to alternatives. Quasqueton, Iowa hog farmer Al Wolfgool says buying semen for his sows gets him better quality pigs than just letting animals mate.
The advantage is they do all the research and then collect the top boars.
While some of the basic biology becomes obsolete, he says Mother Nature can still throw a wrench into the best laid plans.
You get semen twice a week and you have all these animals ready to breed and then you have a snowstorm or an ice storm.
He says he's driven out to meet a delayed courier in an attempt to get fresh semen to the farm while sows are in heat. Back at Swine Genetics International, lab manager Brooke Bielner places a semen sample under a microscope. The image that appears on the connected TV shows wiggling sperm just like the pictures in biology textbooks. Doran says they're monitoring for two qualities.
So motility is how well the semen's moving. And then morphology is, are there any abnormalities to the anatomy of the cell?
His company is one of the few that consistently sends off frozen boar semen, packed and shipped with liquid nitrogen tanks at an average price of about $100 per dose. Those store-bought eggs contribute something to the process. But even when I press Doran, he's vague on the details.
There's a foundation in using a lot of natural ingredients you could find at a grocery store, and it's evolved over time, but we feel like we've developed and evolved a proprietary recipe that, I mean, as we see both in the U.S. and abroad, that we have a very high degree of success with.
Beyond that, he'll only say that milk, yes, milk, also got enlisted in the earliest experiments with mail-order genetics. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris, in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Coming up next on Main Street, Chef Rosie catches and serves smelt.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. Comic books are much more than the silly distraction they're often thought to be. They are, in fact, a literary genre at the height of its maturity and sophistication, and they're only getting better. On our next episode, we're going to ask how and why this is, and explore how to recognize them for the art they are. So join me and Scott McCloud for How to Read a Comic Book on the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is one of our favorite guests, Chef Tim Rosendahl. We call him Chef Rosie. He joins us once a week to talk about food. And Rosie, you want to talk about smelt this week.
You know, smelt is a wonderful freshwater fish. It's really big in the Midwest here because we happen to be on Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And they're very similar to herring, and they're very similar to pickerel and sardines and anchovies, where it's a fish that you can eat the whole fish. Bones, head, tail, fins, the internal organs, you can eat it all. In this part of the country, if they get too big, don't listen to what I just said, because then you do need to cut off the head and you do need to eviscerate. You do need to cut off the fins.
So what is that size when you say, is it too big? Is it bigger than 3 inches or a foot long?
I would say 3 inches gets pretty – that's almost too small to keep.
Okay.
There isn't a minimum though. But four to 6 inches is the optimal size. But when you start seeing them 7, 8, 9, then you have to eviscerate and you have to cut off the tail and the head. Mm-hmm. When I say you have to, I'm sure there's people out there that are smelting on Lake Superior right now on the Knife River. They're going to say, well, I'll be darned if that's true because I'm eating one right now. So there's lots of ways to do things.
Okay. Would you kind of treat it similarly to an anchovy or a sardine where maybe it ends up in on a pizza or in a Caesar salad or something like that?
I have never seen a can of smelt.
Okay.
I have never seen where you see anchovies and sardines. That's the way most of us here in the Midwest, the only way we do see them. Surprise. But because they are very oily fish and they're high in omega-3 fatty acids, they're also very low in mercury because we harvest them as fingerling. The variety or the species of the smelt we like up here is called a rainbow smelt. And because it's low in mercury, it's a very good food for you. It has high nutrition. And the wonderful thing about the flavor on it is you're eating the skin and you're getting the calcium and the vitamin A and the vitamin D and all of the omega-3 acids in it. And they taste really good. When you fry them, whether you deep fry them in corn oil or peanut oil, or you saute or pan fry them in your favorite olive oil. Some people like to bread them with breadcrumbs. Some people just coat them in flour. Some people soak them in buttermilk to draw out some of the blood, if you will. Other people just, like me, we would just put a stick in them, hold them over the fire, crisp them up, and pop them in my mouth. So they can be as simple as that, or they can be fried, and certainly you can make your favorite fish sauce with it.
And if you're going to be on the simple end of that, where it's just a little bit of heat and eat, what's the flavor there? Does it taste like an anchovy, or because it seems like it should taste more like a walleye or something?
You know, in doing some research on smelt, and I've only had smelt 3-4 dozen times in my life, but to compare the flavor of smelt to cucumbers and watermelon is something I read more than once on Google. Mm. And, of course, you can't believe everything you read, but that is kind of a stretch for me. But cucumbers and watermelon, I read, it's very mild. But then again, so many – when people think of fish, they always want to put their nose in it and say, is it fishy? Well, when it's fishy, no fish is that good. You know, there's a time and temperature thing going on there. So I think it's a very mild, flavorful fish, and it's never, if it has a fishy taste, walk away.
So what do you want to eat this with if you are the type who thinks it tastes like cucumbers?
Well, almost any time you go to a smelt fry at your local Eagles or Elks or the VFW or your church. And in the spring, from this time forward till summer, you'll see almost, you know, in the Midwest, I see them all the time. They're almost always fried, and that is deep fried. And that means they're fried in canola oil or vegetable oil. And then they're either sprinkled with fresh lemon juice or some type of vinegar, usually a malt or a cider vinegar. But you eat them just like French fries. They're little crispy sticks. The Greeks call them Greek French fries, and they coat them with matzo meal, and they mix herbs and garlic in it, and then they're probably oregano and parsley and lemon in with the matzo meal. So they're just making these Greek French fries, but they look like a fish-shaped French fry. Maybe that's pushing it a bit.
How do you catch these? I'm just thinking if you want to be optimally eating them that small, boy, you're going to be out there for a long time with a fishing pole.
Well, I know that there's a lot of people listening right now that'll say, what's he talking about smelt eating? That's a bait fish. We use smelt to catch real fish.
Okay.
But that's true with a lot of different fish. And you don't catch these. They're not line caught. They're usually net caught or trapped in some kind of a trap. But they're so small. I've never heard of anybody using a fishing pole to catch smelt. But they are very cannibalistic. I know people that will put pieces of smelt in their traps to attract more smelt, so they are cannibalistic fish. They eat off the bottom. They eat shrimp and they eat mealyworms and they eat, you know, the things that fall to the bottom of the lake floor or ocean floor, just like lobster and crab and shrimp and all of our favorite mollusks and crustaceans. Usually they're bottom dwellers.
Okay. And you said an oily fish. What does that really mean?
That means when you think of cod and scrod and flounder, those are dry, non-oily, low in omega-3 fatty acids fish. Okay. Not that they're not good. You know, cod is one of my favorite fish. But it also, oily means more flavor to me. Mm-hmm. When I think of salmon, when I think of sea trout, when I think of tuna, when I think of smelt, I think of oilier fish. And that usually means that they have a distinct flavor. And it also means, I may be pushing the envelope on this, but when it goes bad because of the oil in the fish, it's a really distinct smell when it gets rancid flavored.
Oh, okay.
And that's what you don't want to have.
Sure.
Smelt is best fresh. But let me tell you, I don't believe there's a grocery store, a major grocery store chain here in the Midwest that doesn't have smelt somewhere in the freezer. So, yes, you can. It freezes. And that's another thing. When it has that much a high oil content, it freezes better. So pick up some frozen smelt at the store. I might soak it in buttermilk. Let it thaw in the refrigerator first, not in hot water. Water was never meant to be a marinade. And then soak it in buttermilk and then just dredge it in either cornmeal or cornstarch or matzah or all-purpose flour and deep fry it. And the simpler, the better. Just salt and pepper and lemon. Wonderful fish.
Mm-hmm. We have such extensive food networks these days that it's easy to eat whatever you want all year. But if you wanted to eat this fresh caught, what's your best timeline here?
When the ice starts breaking, I just came back from Lake Superior. And Lake Superior is, little did I know, one of the largest volume lakes in the world.
Yeah, it's pretty huge.
Yeah, I mean, it's tied for one or two. There's one in Russia that has larger volume, but Lake Superior has larger shoreline, but it's huge. Most of the lake is solid right now. In towards Duluth, there is lots of open water, and some of the rivers that flow in or out of Lake Superior, as the Knife River that I was at last week, they have current, so they're smelting now. But it's the end of March is when it's primarily – that's when I know – and I say that only because I know the shipping lanes in Lake Superior are opening in March 20th to April 1st, somewhere in there. So once the big boats come through, they start cutting up the ice, and then it'll be flowing, and then the smelt will start running. And the running is just those fingerlings running upstream.
All right. Well, we have talked about smelt. If you have a question for Chef Rosa, you can always send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. Rosie, thanks as always.
Happy to be here. It's fun.
What's happening is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And what a poignant question that is, we like to ask on Thursdays as we look ahead to the weekend. Director of Radio Bill Thomas joining me for this week's What's Happening. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sure. Well, everybody's sort of, chipping and breaking their way out of the snowbanks and the driveways piled up and all that stuff and ready to get out and do something. And here's a good one in Minot, the Orphan Train. The Orphan Train is just such an evocative thing, a story that has captured so many people with books and plays. And this is a play on at the Arlene. It's a theatrical version. This is nine orphans on an orphan train that left New York City in 1914 and traveled around, and they would come into a town. Kids would line up. People would come and pick a kid or two and take them away, and it's just weird and to think of, mm-hmm. and like I say, just plucks at people's heartstrings. And in some cases, they worked out really well. Some of the orphans were very happy, and some were abused and died, actually. So anyway, this was sold out when they did it before, so they're doing it this weekend and next weekend at the Arlene in Minot.
The Insider Tour, I love the sound of this. This is coming up on Saturday the 10th in Washburn at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center at Fort Mandan, where they unlock the display cases. Yeah. Are you like me and
you get in?
Have to hold your own hand behind your back because you just try to touch stuff at museums? Well, you can go behind the display case here, look at exhibit elements and collections that, normally stay behind that glass wall they never let you behind. And now you can come and learn about tips about preservation that you might want to try in your own life. You have some beautiful cloth napkins from your grandma or what have you, and you want to preserve them. You can learn how to do that, too. This is from 2 to 3:30 on Saturday the 10th in Washburn at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center at Fort Mandan, and it's free.
This one's not free, but it's a good thing. At the Old Armory Theater in Williston, and it starts tonight, Thursday night, runs Thursday through Sunday, and it is a play about community theater groups putting on plays put on by a community theater group, right? So it's...
Wait, who's on first?
Yeah, right. It's one of those. And looks like a lot of fun. It's called Play On. And it's at the Old Armory Theater in Williston.
The Northern Valley Youth Orchestra is playing Inspired by Nature Sunday the 11th in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center. This is actually made up of three student orchestras performing a variety of symphonic music, much of it inspired by nature. There are $5 raffle tickets available to support the Northern Valley Youth Orchestra, and they are also collecting non-perishable foods for local food banks as part of Orchestra's Feeding America. This concert, Inspired by Nature, is at 3 p.m. on Sunday the 11th in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center. Cost is just $5. Kids 12 and under are free.
And I'm going back to Minot for some music there. The Minot Symphony at Ann Nicole Nelson Hall on this Saturday is putting on a concert, and it's all kinds of like prairie music. It's kind of cool. We've been talking about this some. They've got Aaron Copland with Rodeo, and they got music from films like Dances with Wolves and The Wild Wild West and the theme to The Magnificent Seven, that famous Elmer Bernstein score. So that is being done Saturday, March 10th, Ann Nicole Nelson Hall, 7:30 p.m. in Minot.
You can come in and create and experiment with mixed media arts here Saturday the 10th in Fargo at the Creative Plains Foundation. And you can make your own piece of art working in different mediums from oil pastels to stamps and collaging, kids and adults using this mixed media practice. And you can take what you learn and hopefully try it out on your own. 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday the 10th in Fargo at the Creative Plains Foundation. And it's free.
A lot of times after the midwinter holidays, people start working on their theater productions, and right around now, they all start hitting the stage. So here's another one in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center, and Thursday through Saturday, so starting tonight and going through Saturday night, it's called Melancholy Play, and it's by a wonderful writer, Sarah Rule, and it centers around a woman who is melancholy and how the melancholy kind of attracts people. And then one day she wakes up happy and it like messes up her life.
Okay, here's my pick of the week, the 15th annual Celtic Festival, this Saturday the 10th in Moorhead at the Yum Comp Center. Take in the sights, sounds, and tastes of Celtic heritage. March is traditionally a very important month, at least in the United States, for Celtic history. And you can learn about the button accordion, small pipes, a wire-strung harp. Bill, do you play all those? You probably do play all of those.
I can around a little bit on them. They're not my main instruments. But I love the Celtic festival for the bagpipes.
I know. Well, I was saving the best for
that. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And 10 a.m. to 4 o'clock in Moorhead on Saturday at the Yum Comp Center. And it's free. What's your pick, Bill?
My pick, you got to go to Sydney, Montana to get this. It'll be at the Mondack Heritage Center. Wilbur Raymond is a musician. He plays saxophone, and he is presenting kind of a lecture concert, American Art and Democracy Come Together in Jazz, Monday, March 12th, 7 p.m. at the Mondack Heritage Center in Sydney.
That's what's happening. Dakota Datebook is next.
Oh, Think your family is crazy? Dakota Stage presents Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike March 15th through the 17th and the 22nd through the 25th at Dakota Stage in Bismarck. This hilarious Tony Award-winning comedy follows siblings Vanya and Sonia, whose world is turned upside down by a visit from their used-to-be-famous sister, Masha, and her latest boy toy, Spike. Tickets and more information can be found online at dakotastageltd.com or by calling 701-258-4998.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 8th. On this date in 1904, the Jamestown Weekly Alert newspaper carried an announcement by the Great Northern Railway regarding changes in the uniforms of its employees. Everyone from the head conductor to brakemen and porters would now be required to wear vests and white linen shirts with black ties. Colored ties would not be permitted. Neither would colored shirts. Shoes had to be black leather and well polished. Employees had to be clean-shaven or have neatly trimmed beards. There would be no gaudy jewelry or heavy watch chains. Conductors, of course, had to carry watches, but their watch chains had to be lightweight and understated. No tobacco products would be permitted, and toothpicks were banned. Toothpicks are nothing new. Some anthropologists assert that the toothpick is the earliest tool known to man. There is evidence of toothpick use by Australian Aborigines, North American Indians, and ancient Egyptians. It has been suggested that much of the ancient toothpick use was unnecessary and was cultural rather than practical. Toothpicks gained popularity in the United States in the mid-1800s. The general practice was to whittle a new toothpick when one was needed. When wooden matches were common, it was easy to split them and trim them into toothpicks. Mass production of toothpicks began with entrepreneur Charles Forster of Boston, so people saw no need to buy something they could make themselves. To counter that, Forster paid young men to go into stores and ask for boxes of toothpicks. When they were told the stores didn't carry them, the phony customer put on a show of being upset. Forster would come in a few days later, and the shopkeeper was happy to buy the toothpicks people were asking for. Forster employed the same trick for marketing to restaurants. Soon, the mass-produced toothpick was a status symbol. Young men would stand outside fancy restaurants, picking their teeth as if they had just eaten there. In truth, they couldn't afford it, and they were just putting on a show. It became very fashionable among men to have a toothpick hanging out of their mouth. Women soon picked up the habit, although it was considered somewhat risque for them. Toothpicks eventually came to be associated with a lower class of people. Youngsters we would today consider juvenile delinquents and minor criminals began lounging on street corners with toothpicks. Which brings us back to the Great Northern Railway as it traveled through North Dakota, banning employees from that disreputable use of toothpicks on the job. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm that street corner lounging toothpick user, Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
One genetic mutation, called RAS, is to blame for 30% of all cancers. Scientists have tried for years to combat it.
It got the moniker undruggable because we've been working on it for 35 years, and so far we don't have a drug in the clinic that works.
Going after the white whale of cancer research, plus the latest on President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on imported aluminum and steel on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, why are comics appealing? And are they an important art form? UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein previews this month's episode of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, where he visits with cartoonist and comics theorist Scott McCloud. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.